From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. When it comes to the issue of guns, one of the first thoughts people have is the terrible tragedy of gun violence like mass shootings. But another byproduct of so many guns in society is the high rate of suicide by gun. Today on the show, you'll hear from Eugene State Representative Floyd Brzezanski, who's introduced legislation to increase the wait times to purchase a gun, providing a cooling off period that could prevent some suicides. The thinking behind the bill is that suicide can be an impulsive thought, and having to wait to buy a gun could save lives. Additionally, the bill aims at adding extra restrictions on firearms as a way to buffer against federal intervention. And we'll finish the show with an update on Eugene's new fire services fee. That's next on Oregon on the Record. According to the Pew Research Center, 6 out of 10 gun deaths in America are by suicide. Indeed, having a gun in the home increases the odds that someone there might use it to take their own life. And there's a good deal of evidence that people with suicidal ideation act on the impulse to purchase a gun for self-harm. Today on the show, you'll hear from an Oregon senator who wants to increase the wait times for firearm purchases in order to circumvent this kind of impulsive act in order to save lives. Then in the second part of the show, we'll check in on the controversial fire services fee being enacted by the city of Eugene. Senator Floyd Brzezanski, who is a senator for representing the Eugene Springfield area, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be on the show.
Yeah. Why don't you kind of give our listeners the details about Senate Bill 243? What is it? What will it do?
Well, Senate Bill 243 has been tagged as the Oregon Suicide Prevention and Community Safety Firearms Act.
Okay.
And what's bundled into that act are really three components. The first is dealing with impulse buying that would require a 72-hour period to pass from the time someone goes in to purchase a gun. Once their request for a background check is started, then that is when the 72 hours would begin. And basically what we would do in this scenario is it would require a person, if they went through the background check immediately within the first 5 minutes of their transaction, they would have to wait to receive the gun 72 hours after that point. Now, at the same time, we do know that the background check system does not always run as smoothly as we want. And in some cases, some people are waiting multiple weeks for their certification coming back that they are okay, eligible to purchase a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
If that should happen, then there would be no need for the 72 hours to be imposed at that point because 72 hours has passed since then.
I see.
And Michael, yeah, so what the reason why we're doing this is that with data shown very clearly that unfortunately some individuals who have suicidal tendencies have actually accessed guns in the morning and actually have committed suicide in the afternoon. And we also know that there are individuals who are out with high emotions in a maybe domestic violence situation that could also do the same thing. And it's been well documented that by waiting 72 hours, it allows the individual who's purchasing the weapon that if they have those type of thoughts or commitments, that they will actually rethink their position before they would carry it out. So that's the first part of the act.
Okay.
The second part is dealing with rapid fire components. And basically what we're attempting to do here is to limit the access to these type of components that do in fact cause the weapon to be able to be fired much faster than it is intended to in the sense of how it was built. And as you can imagine, in many of the mass shootings that we've had, rapid fire devices have in fact been on the guns that are being used. And that means that there's more opportunity for bullets to be fired from the gun and such. So it's very important for us to try to limit that by limiting these type of components that are actually there just to increase the firepower, meaning the rapid fire of a weapon.
Yeah, I'm sure many people have heard of them as bump stocks, and certainly the terrible tragedy that happened in Las Vegas. I believe that shooter, his weapons were equipped with bump stocks.
That's right. And so there's multiple different components in the bill that calls out some of them: binary trigger systems, bump stock, like you said, burst trigger systems, hellfire trigger, rapid fire activators. And then we have that somewhat defined as to how that what actually qualifies under that. So again, what we also know is that if you can limit the number of bullets that are able to be fired in a very fast period of time, you can in fact cause individuals to either not be able to achieve their goals or have the opportunity to have other people that are being preyed on to find safety and shelter at that time. So those are the first two. And the last one we have is basically extending local to the local control the opportunity for cities and counties to do what we've done at the state level, and that's basically to allow for them to determine whether or not they want to have concealed weapons in their facilities. Currently, under the current law, these areas are already set up to prohibit any individuals for carrying firearms onto the premises. But as you can may not know this, but if you have a concealed weapons permit, you have the authority to actually use that as a defense if you did enter into property that was prohibited to have firearms. So this is just an extension. This is an extension that we have already for the state government buildings, the Capitol, private and public schools, hospitals, city hall, and elected officials that are statewide office holders.
Okay.
So this is basically going to allow for the cities and the counties to do the same with their property that they control, and that would be specifically expect that to be buildings that they own or they have leases on that they control the the operations and at those locations.
Okay. And then am I also correct that part of this bill also looks at perhaps raising the minimum age to purchase a firearm?
It does not. It did in the original. There
I
were
see.
four components, but through the discussions that we've had and negotiations, as you may call it, that fourth component is no longer in Senate Bill 243. If someone was looking online on the OLIS, which is the Oregon Legislative Information System, they would want to look at SB 243 and then click on amendments and look at the dash three. That's the most current, and that's the bill in its current state that will be worked for approval out of the Senate Judiciary Committee and then to the floor for a vote, then to the House for their consideration.
Okay, thank you, sir. Thank you, Senator. And we are speaking, I'm going to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Senator Floyd Prezansky for representing the Eugene Springfield area. You know, obviously, anytime you're trying to regulate firearms, it raises a lot of controversy, and there's a lot of arguments for and against. And I kind of wondering, you know, in your talks with constituencies or just even colleagues across the aisle who may be in opposition to this, what do you tell them about these kinds of regulations that you're looking at?
Well, what I always do is I really probably remind more people than I tell for the first time. I am a gun owner. I've owned guns since I was age 15. So I've got 55 years or so of owning guns. I was always taught of responsibility and safety. And that's what this bill actually is going to do. It will, in fact, provide for more safety around firearms and ensuring that the community and themselves have some redress or ability to look at the local level as we have done at the state. And it doesn't stop someone from exercising their Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution or the Article 1, Section 27 of the state constitution. I am totally in full support of those two concepts, and I'm actually practicing it by owning guns myself. But I also, as I said, feel that it's very important for us to take reasonable steps, prudent steps that will, in fact, help provide more safety in the community and for individuals who may be at that moment in time faced with a crisis dilemma that they feel that they need to terminate their life. You know, I do have a little bit of experience working with an organization back in Texas that dealt with suicide prevention, And what we always knew is that, you know, a suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And that's where the wait time comes in, because in many cases, individuals can find and seek help from friends or counselors or whoever they may turn to, or they on their own, if it's an emotional, highly charged relationship, take a deep breath and then realize, wait a second, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly read a lot of reports about that, that we often think of the problem with the proliferation of guns in our society. We first think about gun violence, somebody shooting somebody else, and that's obviously a tremendous crisis. But it sounds like this bill really also addresses something that maybe hasn't got as much attention, is how many people we lose to suicide because of guns.
That is very true. The data is very, let's say, forthright as to the amount of suicides that have occurred in the state as well as around the the country. And, you know, it is one of those things that I was looking to see if I had the numbers as to the most recent ones I saw regarding the number of suicides. And what we do know is suicide by gun is almost always going to be successful, unfortunately. Has a success rate of somewhere around 95% from what I, if I remember correctly. And, you know, and it is one of those situations that when we had testimony on the bill, we heard from a number of individuals that came and bear witness for a family member who had taken their life, and that there was no quote unquote warning signs or that was present. And then, unfortunately, in some of those cases, individuals went and purchased a gun within a 24-hour period from the time that they committed suicide, from the time when they purchased the gun.
Yeah. I wonder if you could maybe clear up some confusion from folks, and this is more of a legislative confusion or lawmaking confusion, because I believe that some of the things like bump stocks, I believe that they're federally illegal, but obviously this is a state law. And then also in this state law, you're talking about allowing certain municipalities to regulate firearm usage inside. Just kind of help people understand, if something is federally, if something is made federally illegal, what is the point of also enacting a state law? And then what is the point of legislation allowing municipalities to follow state law? I'm just wondering if people get confused about which law supersedes the other, or what is the reason for having multiple laws, you know, dictating something like a firearm?
Yeah. So let's call it dual jurisdiction. Okay. And basically the federal system has set up and said that these are illegal. The states have their ability to do the same. Why would you want to necessarily do that? There are many cases where because on the limited resources in the federal system that you may not see action being able to be taken, where if it's at the state level, those more local organizations or authorities could in fact have a response and actually be able to follow through with that. And so that would just, that just really allows for the opportunity for both the state or the federal government to be able to take action against an individual who's in illegally possessing such a weapon or a component.
Okay. Obviously, we're all very familiar with Measure 114, which was a ballot initiative that put some restrictions in place for guns. And then there was a judge that stayed it, and it's been sort of in limbo for quite some time. Are you concerned that even if this bill passes and is signed by the governor, that it could suffer the same kind of delay that happened with Measure 114? Or is that just sort of the nature of the beast when you're dealing with something like gun legislation?
Yeah, any legislation can be tied up in litigation, and with the exception that something that is passed with an emergency clause that goes into effect directly upon signature. The others are, in fact, subject to being challenged. Not that they couldn't be challenged even with the emergency clause, but it wouldn't stop them from going into action or becoming active unless a court was asked to intervene and put a stay or temporary stay on the bill while the litigation is going forward. So, that just kind of goes with the course of any type of legislation. But as you have mentioned, Michael, I think part of this is a lot of emotion that individuals have as to what they feel is appropriate or not. And that's one of the reasons I'm going to go back to that other question you asked regarding at the local level. Why extend this to the local level instead of just maybe leaving it at the state where it's at? What we decided is that this is really something that each community should have the ability to make their own decisions as to what works for them. We always hear about Eastern Oregon versus the Willamette Valley. And so this is one of those opportunities that would, in fact, allow for those communities who prefer to have this type of regulation to do so without imposing that on a statewide basis for all cities and all counties.
Got it. Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking with Senator Floyd Przanski. He is a senator from the Eugene-Springfield area. Is there some concern given that, gun rights is so intertwined with the Trump administration's base? Are you concerned that the federal government is going to look at something like this and try and do something?
Well, I hope they do try to do something. I hope they try to join us in making sure communities across this country are safe, giving those local communities the opportunity, if they choose to have some type of regulations on their public buildings. And at the same time, why not have someone take a 72-hour break, a deep, deep breath before they take possession of a firearm? I mean, I know for myself, when I was hunting, I had the weapons that I needed. If I wanted one, I sure in the heck am going to go out there and be looking to buy a new hunting rifle to take off the next day to go hunting. I mean, I just do whatever they would like to try to do. But we do have a thing called the 10th Amendment and the state and the U.S. Constitution that does guarantee some states' rights. And I believe there's enough arguments that could be made for health and safety to be able to have a state law within its own jurisdiction to withstand those type of challenges.
Senator Floyd Przanski from Eugene Springfield, really appreciate you taking the time during the busy legislative session to chat with us. Thank you so much.
Michael, thank you very much for the opportunity, and hope your day goes well.
Now let's spend a few minutes getting caught up on the Eugene Fire Services fee. Rebecca Hansen-White, always good to see you. Thanks so much for coming in and chatting with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, so you've been following what is sort of the issue in Eugene right now, this fire services fee. But for our audience, just kind of tell us what it is, how it sort of got into place, sort of where we are with it.
Yeah, so what the fire service fee is it's a monthly fee. Mm-hmm. So the average resident would pay about $10 a month, and the average business is going to pay, if it continues, $38 a month. And so it's on your eWeb bills. It's not an eWeb charge. It's a City of Eugene charge.
Okay.
To balance their budget. So roughly $8 million will keep current services where they're at. $2 million is going to be for expanding fire services a little bit, not that much.
Okay.
And then that will help close, not completely, but help close roughly an $11.5 million budget gap.
Okay. And the city council took action on this just fairly recently, like a couple month or two ago, something like that?
Yeah. So they have been discussing it for a long time, mm-hmm. a year, that this has been discussed in some manner, because this budget crisis has been in the works for over a year as well. So they've been looking for a way, because they can't just raise property taxes, to be able to close that gap. So it didn't actually get a real vote until February. And then pretty soon after, a group of businesses with the Eugene Chamber of Commerce, raised funds to gather signatures and got a referendum to let the people of Eugene to decide whether they want to pay the fee.
Okay. And what's going on with that? What's the status there?
Yeah, so they have gotten everything they need. They've gotten their signatures verified, so they are good to appear on the November ballot. Now, what happens next is really in the City of Eugene, the Eugene City Council's court right now. So they had a meeting yesterday to decide possibly what to do next. And they've got a few options
okay.
That the state law allows them to respond. So they could do nothing. Nothing is always a choice.
it's one of my favorite choices.
They could just let it proceed to the ballot in mm-hmm. November. The problem with letting it proceed as normal, if you think that's a problem, is that if they do nothing, or basically every option is still this, but they're going to have to cut $11.5 million from the budget in July. And if they wait until November for the election to happen, then we will be without those services for months. And, you know, if voters decide, hey, we want those services back, we'll decide to put the fee on ourselves, then even if you want to bring everyone back, it's, you know, that means people have been laid off. So, you know, you'll have to hire again for those positions. Some of those things might be hard to restore. So that's an option. They could move the election up to August. So then we would only have the cuts for a month. And there are some people that seem potentially interested in this. So it seems a little more possible. They could write an alternate ballot measure to appear alongside the referendum. That's a possibility. There is a deadline to do that as well. Or they could repeal the fire fee completely, which would make a ballot measure unnecessary. So no fire fee and then cuts and then no vote.
Okay. Any indication as to when the city council is going to choose one of those options?
So they do have a work session scheduled on April 21st to discuss their choices. So, you know, we have a little time before they do that. And there was some city council members who were hoping maybe during that work session or, you know, in the week leading up to it to gather some more community feedback about how the community is interested in solving that problem. So that's a potential option, but they'll probably during that work session make a decision, because if they do want to put it on the ballot in August, you know, they can't wait forever to do that. And if they want some of those other choices, they have to make a decision before September to have enough time to place an alternate on the ballot.
Well, Rebecca Hanson-White, always appreciate you coming in and updating us. Thanks so much. That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Monday on the show, you've seen him in hit movies like Gross Point Blank and The Kingdom and the hit HBO series Entourage. But Jeremy Piven is so much more than just an actor, and he's bringing his stand-up comedy to Eugene, and we'll have a conversation with him next week. I'm Michael Dunn, and this has been Oregon on the Record from KLCC. Thanks for listening.